This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Ohio, like other states, is set to reopen its economy slowly, even as more confirmed cases of COVID-19 continue to come in. And state leaders announced significant budget cuts prompted by the pandemic, hitting healthcare and education hard. Governor Mike DeWine joined me on the phone this morning to talk about it. Here's our pre-recorded interview. Governor Mike DeWine, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Good to be back. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for taking some time. We know you're quite busy these days. You made some news yesterday with the announcement about cuts related to the COVID-19 pandemic and the fiscal situation in the state of Ohio. I want to start with the cuts that were announced to Medicaid, $210 million from Medicaid. Is it anticipated that those cuts will impact medical care for the poorest people in the state and perhaps people more vulnerable to COVID-19?
No, we don't think so. That's not what we intend to do at all. As you know, Medicaid is a huge part of the budget. I've had my Medicaid director, take a look and see where we can make some cuts. And, they're still working on exactly where those will be. But there'll be some announcement today about it from our budget director. But, we don't think so. If you look at what we have to do, kind of the basics are, of course, we have to balance our budget every year. We can't print money. And we have to balance it. Our year, of course, ends at the end of June. And so then we start a new year. The cuts that we just announced will enable us to have a balanced budget by the end of this year. Then we start back up, of course, next year. When you look at the whole kind of budget, there's only about 8 or 9% of the budget that really is what you would normally consider kind of state government services. And the rest of it is pretty much transfer payments that go back to schools, go back to our colleges and universities, and also go to our local communities for social services. So, for example, we're not going to make cuts in what we're sending back for children's services. We were able to raise that money last year. We're going to try to protect that money. We are going to protect that money. And so we're trying to be very careful and not have a huge impact on the most disadvantaged people. For example, the schools, the cut formula, which comes up to an average of about 3.7% for this past year, for the schools, that certainly is a significant cut. We're spreading that out based upon wealth, based upon poverty, in the sense that the poorer districts will get really less of a cut. The schools will also be getting, and I didn't talk about this at all yesterday because it is separate, but over the next year they're going to have CARES money, they're going to have federal money that's going to come in. And in some cases, that will certainly compensate for this cut. We're not underestimating the cut, and I certainly would not do that. We know it's significant, but that is the other part of the story, that there is some federal dollars, thank heavens, coming into the schools that will be of assistance to them.
So when we hear about $355 million in cuts to education, $210 million from higher education, you think that some of that pain will be staved off by contributions from federal assistance?
Yeah, certainly in the education it will. But again, I'm not underestimating that. These are significant cuts. What we had a choice, really. We could forego some of these cuts now, but it would have pushed additional cuts into next year. What we're trying to do, and no one can really predict this economy, but what we're trying to do is to have some stability and funding for schools so that when they go into next year, we don't have to keep imposing additional cuts as we move through the year. Now, there's no guarantee we won't have to do that, but that's our goal. I'll be very transparent. Our goal is to, be able to give some predictability to schools. What superintendents tell me, school board members, and parents is give us some predictability. With this economy, there's really no predictability, but like making these cuts now You know, we think there's a much better chance that we'll be able to stay kind of in a straight line for schools as we go through next year than if we would have pushed these cuts back and tried to figure out how to get them as we go through the year. So stability is something that, you know, we certainly were trying to do. When you look at the budget, I know people listening may say, why would you take it out of Medicaid? Why would you take it out of education? The truth is that if you look at the full budget, there's 8 to 9% that's really just kind of state government. The rest of it is transfer payments that are transferred through, which includes education, which includes Medicaid. And Medicaid and education are just two huge, huge items in the budget. And if you would exempt them, you simply cannot find the money to balance the budget, which we are required by law to do. We have no choice. We have to balance that budget every single year. So we're making cuts in government. We've had a hiring freeze going on since for the last few weeks that I ordered. We've got 300 less people working just by attrition. We're not hiring any new people. So we've imposed cuts all across state government. The only place where, frankly, we couldn't make cuts was in the prisons, because that is the great, great, great bulk of that people, and you need so many people to be in the prisons for the officers to be safe. We have seen speaking of prisons, by the way, we have seen a pretty significant reduction in number of prisoners, and you know those numbers have been going down. We're having fewer people coming in. We're also doing some strategic early releases. The law says that when you get within 90 days of your sentence, that if there is overcrowding in the prison, that the state can release these individuals. So we're not releasing any sex offenders. We're not releasing anybody that we think is a high probability of being dangerous. But some of these people that are getting within 90 days of their sentence anyway, we are going to cut them loose. We are cutting them loose to make more room inside the prison. So,
and we're talking with Governor Mike DeWine of Ohio today here on Cincinnati Edition. And Governor, as of Tuesday, Ohio's total coronavirus cases hit almost 21,000, 20,969, another 495 confirmed cases added on Tuesday. Deaths topped the 1,000 mark. And of course, these are people we're talking about, not just numbers. But the state is beginning to slowly reopen. As you see these numbers continue to come in and the state starts to mobilize for its reopening, what are your concerns? What are your hopes?
Well, we certainly have concerns. This virus is still very much out there. It's not going away. It's not going to go away. We have more capacity to deal with it. We now have the ability to do a lot more testing. We're standing up now a much more vigorous tracing program, which simply means that we can go on the offense and on a voluntary basis try to reach people who have been tested positive and then find out who they have been in contact with. And this is a traditional tracing program. It's nothing new, but we're taking it to a much higher level. And of course, we have so many more cases. So we're going to do that more. We are doing that more. So we're happy about that. I'm looking at numbers, for example. The number I look at every morning is hospitalizations. And I look at I'm now looking at in a 21-day trend average. And what you're seeing in hospitalizations is a fairly flat line now. We were getting some downward trend. Yesterday, we popped back up, and we've popped up again today. So I'm looking to see, you know, where the trend line is there. What we would hope to see is not only a plateau, which it appears we're in now, where each day is about the same as the other day, what we would hope to see is beginning a downward trend in that. So we're kind of at a plateau there. We know that as we open up the economy, you're going to have more contact, more opportunity for people to have contact and to spread the virus. We're now at about a one-to-one number, we think, which means that every person who's infected will infect someone else. you know, the goal would be to get that below that. You know, what we may see as we open this economy up is those numbers start going up. And so we can't remain closed for the next year or whatever it is until we get an immunization. But on the other hand, we have to be careful. And a lot of this is not, most of this is not what I say, not what my health director says, not any orders we issue. This comes down to people and what people do, what the residents of Ohio do, how they, practice social distancing. I know there's controversy about people wearing masks, but look, we know that if you put social distancing, you stay more than 6 feet away, you wear a mask, the other guy wears a mask, the other woman wears a mask. We know that those two things combined protect both of us better. And that's the message that we're trying to get out to people. As we open up, we've had, we put business groups together and put business groups, let's say the hair salons, barbers. We have a group working, and these are barbers. These are hair salons. These are people who do hair. And we put in those groups health department people. So we've charged them, come back with the best practices. What would be the best practices when we open up? We've done the same thing with retail. We've done the same thing with restaurants. I'm looking at today, for example, reports from the hair group, reports from the restaurant group. And so that when we open both of these up, we can do it with a regiment protocol that is the best that we can put together. But again, even when you do that, people who are at a high risk probably need to continue to stay home. If you're over 60, 65, certainly over 70, people who have under 70 who have medical problems, they need to be very careful because if you look at the mortality rate, the older a person gets, the higher the mortality rate is if you get this. And it's not just the deaths. It is what people go through who recover. I know people who have this who are recovering from it, who've had it for a month. And, you know, it's been tough. I mean, very, very, very tough. They're going to make it. They're going to live. They're not going to show up on the death numbers. But they are just... it's been a hell of a month of hell for them.
And Governor, so if I can,
it's a balance. It's a balance that we're trying to achieve. And anyway.
Okay. Well, Governor, you fall into that age group of the vulnerable population, respectfully, and I'm wondering how this reopening impacts the way that you will do your job. Will you be out in the community or will you be taking extra precautions?
Well, Fran and I have been staying at our home that we've lived in on a farm for four decades, and we are frankly being careful. I do a lot of the things that I do with conference calls. We have video conferencing. Where it really has the most impact is with our kids. We have four grandkids that and our daughter, two daughters who live down the road, and son-in-law. And, we walk down there, but, we don't go in. We don't get real close to them. Same thing with our other grandchildren. So, we're trying to be very careful. And that's what I would recommend to anybody who is, our age, to be careful. And what the other thing that we remind people who, somebody says, look, I'm 25. Hey, I'm not worried. Well, you can be a carrier. And if you're not worried for yourself and if you want to take the chance, that's your call, your decision. But if you've got anybody in your home, if you visit anyone, what makes this, one of the things that makes this so dangerous is that we have so many people who show absolutely no symptoms and they have it. We've tested significantly in our prisons. Prisons are very difficult because of the congregate living. They're not. We have 60% of our prisoners who are not in cells. They're out. They're out in kind of a open bay living arrangement, like almost like a dorm. And so we've had to go in there and do significant testing. One of the things we found is that there's a significant number of people who show absolutely no symptoms. We're taking their temperature every day. We're watching them every day. They show no symptoms, and they test positive. So, you know, we know that that's true outside the prisons, too. And so if there's so many people that you come in contact with that they don't know they have it, you don't know they have it, but they have it. And that's why, again, back to basics, you know, the mask, distancing, these are all things that, people need to do. And one of the concerns I have, you asked me about what concerns I have, and you know, we've got to move forward, but we've got to move forward very carefully. And I today, at least in Cedarville, it's not a very pretty day. It's raining. I suspect it may be down in Cincinnati as well. You know, we've had some beautiful days, and it's May, and we're going to continue to have beautiful days, and people want to get out. And so we just want them to be cautious. The state parks are open. Many of the metro parks are open. There's many opportunities for people to do fun things. But you've got to be careful. You got to keep the social distance. And, you know, if wearing the mask, again, some people don't want to wear a mask, but you're really wearing a mask not for you. You're wearing it for the other guy.
Governor,
and if everybody does it, we're all going to be safer.
I know we're short on time. I'm hoping that I can play a soundbite for you and just get a quick reaction. I spoke on yesterday's show to Dr. Erwin Redliner. He's the director of the National Center for Emergency Preparedness at Columbia University. Here's what he had to say about reopening.
As I spoke to the mayors of the two largest cities in Georgia, mayors of Atlanta and Augusta over the weekend, and both of those mayors are deeply worried about a resurgence. And the modelers are telling us that if you reopen without testing and without appropriate case tracking, people are positive, you're going to get a big surge again. So that's a heavy responsibility for a governor to take, and I'm just urging extreme caution.
And Governor, you just mentioned how in the prisons where you were testing everyone, you found so many asymptomatic people. We're going to have more people out as the economy reopens. It's probably safe to assume there are asymptomatic people who may be walking around. If we see a significant spike in cases, do you anticipate that the state would have to enforce a stay-at-home order again?
Well, we don't want to have to do that. And what I said is that, you know, no one wants to go back, but that is a concern. I mean, the clip that you played, you know, he's spot on in regard to the concern that we have. The other side of this is that when you have a down economy like we do today, there are other things that go wrong and that are not good, and they're not just economic. Historically, I don't have any numbers for the last few months, but historically, domestic violence goes up, depression goes up, and I could go through a long, long list of things that happen that are not only bad for the economy, but that are bad from a personal health point of view. So trying to figure this out is not easy, and you know, we're taking this thing day by day. I'm looking at numbers every single day. There are many people who I know are listening to your show today who say, DeWine, you're not moving fast enough. You know, what are you doing? How come, you know, Indiana's open and doing this? How come you're not doing it? And the answer, you know, and then we have people, I'm sure, who are listening who say, you're moving much too fast. And so we're trying to get the right balance. This is not a public opinion poll that we're following, but rather it is trying to get this right. And, you know, trying to find that sweet spot as we move forward. But I know we're running out of time, but I want to make another point again.
I have as much time as you need, Governor.
Yeah. The most important thing for the listeners is it's not what I do. It is what you do. And, you know, when you go up and you see a bunch of people who are, you know, it's a nice day, and there's no social distancing going on, you know, I'm not telling you to go talk to them. I would suggest that. But I'm just saying that's a sign we have a problem. And we have to treat this virus with a great deal of respect. You know, I've likened it to a monster out there. And it can move from person to person But the only way it advances is if we help it advance. It has to find a host. It has to go from one person to the other. And if we don't allow it to do that, then we slow it down.
And Governor, you and Dr. Amy Atkin, at some point early on in this, saw signs that prompted you to make the choices that you made to keep people as far away from each other as possible. What type of conversations are happening internally in the state government? Are there any forecasts or models that say, if we get to this number, we're going to have to enact these again?
We've not set a number. What we did, of course, as you know, Ohio had a choice early, and the choice was the Arnold Classic in Columbus, which brought this issue up much earlier than for most states, and we canceled it. We didn't cancel it. We let it go on, but we didn't allow spectators. And, you know, we had 60,000 people going to come into central Ohio from 80 countries, and we just said no. So we made these decisions earlier than other states did, at least a little bit earlier than most did. And it was based on data that we were looking at. It was based on the best medical practices. So we were early. We now have a lot more testing than we had before. So I'm not, I don't say that we're in a great position, but we're certainly in a better position to move forward than we were. But we're going to watch the numbers. We're going to watch them every single day. We're going to try to, again, communicate to the people of Ohio that we want to move forward economically. But you have to be very, 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 very careful.
Governor Mike DeWine of Ohio, thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to talking to you again. I'll note that you're not giving a press conference today, right?
We're not giving a press conference today. We kind of felt that we went 40 straight days or something without a day, and then we went to a 5 day a week. And the state legislature is in session today, so the Ohio Channel normally covers it. We thought it was an opportunity, frankly, to hunker down and not do that hour and a half press conference and take that hour and a half and to work on things that we need to be working on. So that's what we're doing today.
Well, we'll see you, I guess, at 2 o'clock on Thursday then. Governor, thank you so much for your time.
that's the goal. Thank you very much.
Up next, local business owners finding ways to adapt during the pandemic as restrictions loosen and some plan to reopen. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Laura Davis is the owner of Core Clay and the co-owner of Brew House here in Cincinnati. She's ready to reopen one of them, but not the other. So let's talk about that. Laura, welcome to the show.
Hello. This is Laura.
Hi, Laura. I'm glad that you could be with us today. You're in an interesting position because you have a stake in a couple of different businesses impacted by the pandemic, and restrictions are starting to ease, and retail sector is starting to reopen soon, and restaurants have been shut down but have been offering carryout, but not yours. So let's get into that first. You're the co-owner of Brew House with your brother in Walnut Hills, and Brew House is boarded up. Why did you opt to go that route instead of trying to maintain some type of business?
Well, we looked at the number of restaurants that we had in the neighborhood and the carryout. We did it for a week or so, and then we realized that there just wasn't enough business to sustain the restaurants that existed. We're one of the older ones, and we thought, well, if we don't do carryout, it'll help some of the others, and it'll give us a chance to do some work on the building, because since we have been, that location's been a restaurant since 1947, and parts of it have not been repaired since then. So we decided to do some cleaning and some, updates that needed to be done. in hopes that it would help everybody else to, you know, narrow the selections for people.
So you looked at this as an opportunity to be friendlier to the other restaurants up there, to take one more option off the market.
Yeah. Yep. Because there's just not enough space for all of us in the carryout market right now.
And we have spoken previously with some other restaurant owners who took a similar route, that they couldn't make the numbers work for themselves, that it was best for their employees if they just shut down and allowed them to collect unemployment. Is that something else that you saw?
Exactly. Yep. It just wasn't, I mean, it's not, you know, when we have a tip-based economy for restaurants, it's just not working to pay people hourly in the same way. You know, it just doesn't, the numbers don't make sense. So.
How many employees were impacted by the decision at Brewhouse?
I think 15. So more or less around 15.
How are they doing?
You know, one of them lives next door to me, and she is anxious every day that we reopen, but she's also been the person who's in there cleaning and scrubbing and doing everything that she can to make it the most beautiful place possible. I know our head of the kitchen is in there working on things every day, trying to make sure everything looks beautiful. But I know some of my other employees have basically been at home since this started. And if you guys are listening, I love you. and it's hard on them. You know, they don't know when this is going to end. And I don't see when restaurants are going to be able to really operate fully, you know, until we have a vaccine. So.
And that's really the question, is what do restaurants look like when they reopen? It's not going to be like it was before, at least not right away. It sounds like some places that have already allowed them to reopen have some pretty strict social distancing guidelines. And how long do you foresee Brewhouse having to remain closed? You're not looking at possibly staying closed until the vaccine, are you?
It depends on the numbers. It really depends on how things change, you know. When we open and close again, we lose a lot of food product, you know. So we're looking at tailoring the menu a little bit more to only things that we can freeze easily, things like that. We're trying to figure out ways that we can do this and not have as much food waste as we had the first time around. But I don't know how we can, you know, our physical setup isn't designed for social distancing. You know, it's a restaurant since 1947, so like there's booths instead of freestanding tables, and you can't social distance a booth, you know.
That's an interesting point, that there are just some natural deficiencies, I guess, as it relates to social distancing, and some of you will be at a disadvantage.
Yeah, yep. And, you know, because we've been a restaurant for so long, we have a lot of older customers. So we worry very much about having them get infected, and we don't want, you know, in a family restaurant, you have a family of customers, and it's a terrifying thing to think that you could infect somebody, you know. So
we're talking with Laura Davis. She's the owner of Core Clay and the co-owner of Brewhouse. One is a retail business, one is a restaurant, both impacted by the pandemic. Laura, did you seek any assistance from the federal programs that were announced?
You know, we were ready to do that, and then the first time it ran out of money, and the second time, I'm gun-shy now. We have not sought it because, you know, there's a level of trust on whether or not that money will go to the smaller businesses, and I don't have it. And also, I'm not sure that I entirely trust that money to be as straightforward as it's meant to sound. You know, that if I take the loan and I take on the cost of what the loan says I have to use it for, and then somehow I don't manage to fulfill it all, at the end I have to give it back, you know, I have to pay it back, and I won't have had any business to cover the costs of it, you know. So we haven't applied for the loans because it just doesn't seem like it's worth the time or the risk.
Laura, as you just said, you made a decision to shutter for a variety of reasons, but one was to be friendlier to your neighboring businesses so that there were fewer options for people who were looking to patronize food establishments. So that suggests that you have a pretty close relationship there in the Walnut Hills neighborhood with the other businesses. What are you hearing from some of the businesses that have stayed open? How are they doing?
Some of them are doing pretty well, I think. There's some businesses that are just more designed for carryout. I know Just Q'n seems to be pulling in the same group of people that I saw before. So, I think that it has affected each restaurant differently. And every one of my friends that I talk to is getting carryout constantly. So, but it's also been hard to keep up with everybody because at my other business, we're moving. So, it's been hard to be on in constant contact with people.
Let's talk about your other business. We've got you on because you've got this unique perspective of being an owner of a restaurant and also of a retail store, and that's Core Clay. For those of us who aren't familiar, tell us what Core Clay is.
So Core Clay is a pottery studio and a communal teaching studio, a pottery studio, and a retail space. So we have sort of three different things we do here, because I believe in making my life as complicated as possible.
And you just said you're moving. Are you finding a new location?
Yeah, we bought a building in Norwood that we've been working on this move since December. Actually, for almost a year now, we've been working on the move. And of course, it all came together during pandemic apocalypse. So it's kind of amazing timing. But it's also, we had to be closed for a certain amount of time anyway, so it's kind of worked out okay.
And it looks like retail is set to come online next Monday, May 12th.
Right.
Is that something that you expect to recognize and reopen?
Well, so we hope we're going to be on schedule to do that. We got to get all the shelves built. But we are an essential business because we sell to professional potters. So we've been able to do curbside pickup for everyone, and we are looking forward to being open for the retail portion because we're not Lowe's, we're not Michael's, we don't have a ton of people coming in at the same time, so we probably have one to two customers at a time. A real rush for us is like five people in the store, so it's not too terrifying for crowd control. New location has a sink right next to the door, so we're going to ask people to wear a mask to come in, because if you don't have a mask, we can still bring stuff out to you. It's no problem, but for the safety of all of my employees, we're going to do that, and we have a sink so people can wash their hands if they're handling anything, and we're just going to keep practicing the social distancing that we've been doing, so hopefully it'll stay safe. But the studio and the classes are probably much slower to open than the retail, and that's where we make our majority of our income.
Did you have employees impacted by this as well, or did you already plan to close for a while?
No, we had employees impacted. So we have several that are on unemployment, and then several that have helped me with the move. And we've managed, because of the move, we are almost never in the same room with anybody. So it's kind of perfect. We're socially distanced by chance as well as by intention. So,
well, I heard you say, Laura, that you like to make your life complicated. I know you were joking about that, but I want to ask you about that in the context of entrepreneurship, because it sounds like you're a serial entrepreneur, they say, I guess. You've got a couple of businesses, and they're in
Didn't
different industries.
To.
It happens.
Yep.
So you've got a restaurant that you go in with your brother. You've got this studio as well. What is this situation, this economic downturn and this health scare that all of us face? What has that done to your mindset as someone who was willing to take such risk with their lives and going into this on your own?
Yeah, it's every other day I'm really hopeful, and the ones in between I'm not. So I don't know where this is all going. When everything shut down, it was the busiest we've ever been at the studio. And the restaurant, both of them were hitting points of popularity that we'd never had before, and it was great. And then, you know, within the period of 24 hours, I had to tell everybody at both businesses that we couldn't employ them anymore, you know. And it's brutal. It's really brutal. And I, you know, both of them are small businesses, so we're family. You know, I have a couple of employees that work at both businesses. And it's really hard to tell people who depended on you that you can't help them. It's an awful feeling. And, you know, I stayed in bed for a couple of days. Then we got our transfer papers to be able to transfer license in Norwood, and we decided to work on the move. And that was hopeful, but it keeps dawning on me that I'm going to need a lot more business coming in to make any income at all. So,
strange time to adjust your business model. And I know that you said there's uncertainty currently, but if you do lie awake, or if you're sitting alone and thinking about things on one of those in-between bad days that you have, what are you hoping for on the other side of this?
I'm hoping for a vaccine, and I'm hoping for science. You know, I'm hoping for people to take this seriously and behave responsibly. You know, I am incredibly encouraged by the political situation in Ohio. I'm a fairly progressive person, and I am so proud of our governor. And it's been a long time since I just stopped looking at parties and started looking at the job that people are doing. And I'm just so proud of our governor and of Dr. Acton. So I'm looking for things to be a little more measured and more reasonable for people to talk to each other. I think that's the one thing that I see that's good from this, is that science is getting a good showing. And I hope that that we all get to hang out with each other again sometime in the next year.
I agree. It's been lonely in the studio, I can tell you that. All these interviews by phone.
I know.
Laura Davis.
I miss eye contact.
We'll have you in the studio, hopefully, when all this is over, to talk about the aftermath and how it all looks. Laura Davis is the owner of Core Clay and Core Clay and the co-owner of Brew House. Laura, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Bye.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Two local entrepreneurs are teamed up to produce masks. Rosie Kovacs is the co-founder and CEO of Sew Valley. That's S-E-W as in sewing, Sew Valley. Rosie's on the phone with us. Rosie, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we've also got with us Jessica Hemmer. She's the founder and creative director of Hemmer Design. Jessica, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thank you.
So let's get started, I guess, with a quick explanation of what both of you do before we talk about how you've come together here. Rosie, I know we've had you on before to talk about Sew Valley, so just give us a quick reminder.
Yeah, Sew Valley exists to help designer entrepreneurs to help build their brands, particularly for apparel. We offer small batch production and development work for apparel brands.
And Jessica, tell us about Hemmer Design.
So I run an apparel design consultancy. So we focus on apparel and soft goods design. We do trend forecasting, product development, design, material development, and advanced manufacturing.
Okay, so Rosie, let's start with you. How did the two of you bring your businesses together to put masks out?
Sure. So we were actually, Jessica and I are personal friends as well as business colleagues. And we were working with UC on some early development work in the middle of March, just to sort of rapid prototype some PPE and kind of figure out what the local landscape looked like for that. And really, we just felt like it was a good partnership. She's an expert in sourcing and technical fabrication and fabrics. And that's something that we needed, and we had the capabilities to actually manufacture, so it made sense for us to partner and try to challenge ourselves to see if we could retool our entire facility to produce what was needed.
And Jessica, tell us about the process that you go through to produce these masks.
Yeah, so it's been a roller coaster as we've gone through it, so a lot of strategy and conversations at the beginning as to what's needed, what's the actual, like, a good design and a good material to be using, and how do we source that at cost, you know, at a good cost. And from there, we went into product development. So we prototyped the mask, and then Rosie and her team were able to take that and figure out how to streamline it through the production process. And then we had to make sure that we actually had people who needed the masks, which was probably the simplest part of the whole equation, which we just had people reaching out to us really early on before we even had masks available, where whether it was agencies, you know, the city has reached out to us. We have different organizations that are looking for donations even. So the Homeless Coalition, we're doing something with them. And we just, from there, we've been rocking and rolling and kind of coming up with different mask iterations and figuring out what to do next in regards to what the need is.
Rosie, to be clear, I heard you mention PPE in your discussion about working with UC. Are these those medical grade masks, or are these more of the cloth masks that many of us are wearing?
So currently our offering is what we're calling an urban grade mask. It's something that is made of mostly 100% cotton. Our first batch, so to speak, that we went through for our, we'll call it our practice round while we were training our new employees. That was a coated cotton, so it was water repellent on the inside and on the outside. And then moving forward, you know, the supply chain has been kind of up and down and crazy just because there's so many people trying to get their hands on materials. We are, we've ordered what we could find, basically, at a good cost. And then going forward, we will probably introduce new designs and new styles based on people's preferences and certain needs, like Jessica was saying. But right now, these are just the urban grade mask. Our first style is basically a filter cover. It has a couple pleats. It's a woven cotton, and then has ties to tie around the back and the neck.
Jessica, I want to ask you about the design of these things, because I ordered some masks recently online, and as these things go, my Facebook feed is now full of ads for masks that I can buy from a variety of companies, including a lot of clothing companies, a lot of independent clothing manufacturers, and the designs are interesting, and they're cool. What's happening in the design industry in this weird situation that we're all in? Are people fully invested in, you know, trying to keep up with fashion trends and this new fashion must have?
So I think that at first it was, how can we help? You know, I think that's what a lot of brands were really focusing on is, you know, we know material, we know manufacturing, how can we get something to be helpful, whether it's to, you know, medical workers or to the general public. But then I think it also was, you know, brands were pulling themselves into this, because they were trying to figure out, how do we stay afloat? How do we have another income stream if our regular, you know, product is not being purchased at the same rate that it used to be purchased? And then I think going forward, it's going to be, to your point around fashion, it's right now, it's a lot of utilitarian looks, which is what we're really focusing on right now. It's like we have a lot of people who need masks, and it's really about how can we get those through the manufacturing process and out to people into their hands so they can wear them and use them day to day. But as these become more and more a part of our lives, which is what I think is going to happen, is that this is going to be the next 12 to 18 months that we're going to be wearing masks, at least. It might become a part of our everyday life going forward just because of people needing to feel comfortable being out in public. But I think there will be more of a push for, you know, just in a lot of different materials and fabrics, but how do we make them even more fashionable and a part of, you know, a piece of your wardrobe? I think that's probably going to be the next wave of what happens. But right now, I still think we're solidly in the part of the process of, we just need to make masks so people can get out and function in the world.
And we're talking with Rosie Kovacs, the co-founder and CEO of So Valley, and Jessica Hemmer, the founder and creative director of Hemmer Design. You both operate businesses, so I do want to talk about the impact on those, even though you've pivoted to adjust in what sounds like the equivalent of restaurants trying to focus more on carryout and delivery options. You've done what you can still do to try to keep busy and to stay afloat. Rosie, what impact has So Valley seen because of the pandemic?
Well, in early March, we furloughed all of our stores. Everybody, all of our management team went home to work on their projects. And we continued to work from home as best as we could on our existing clients. work. And then we were given a small grant from the Hale Foundation in March after we made a decision to get back to work and see what we could do to ramp up our production and shift everything to produce masks. So really, bigger picture, it's been kind of helpful for our business. I'm really glad that we can participate and do what we can to help out. But we've essentially hired back our original team as well as an additional force. We've been rapidly training new sewists. We have that makes 12 total on our team today. So it's actually been quite a whirlwind of an experience trying to find the right sewers, train them, also purchase new equipment, figure out how to do an assembly line for this particular style, and then looking ahead at new styles and what customers want and how we can change that, as well as continuing to work on our existing client work. So we've been quite busy.
Yeah, I mean, so that is a whirlwind. It sounds like over the past 6 weeks, as we've gone through the bulk of this thing, that you went from what a lot of businesses were doing, furloughing their employees, to bringing people back and then expanding?
Pretty much, yeah.
And Jessica, how about on your end? I know you work with a lot of up-and-coming designers as well. What's the impact been on your business?
So I have been incredibly fortunate. I have some retainer clients that I've been able to continue on with my contracts with them, but the work has slowed, but I have a sense of security in the relationship that I have with them. So that's been really good, and that's given me the freedom to kind of pivot and to focus more on this PPE situation in general. So beyond just the urban grade masks, I've been pulled into a lot of conversations nationwide around PPE production. So working with facilities in Boston and Chicago and New York City and helping to source materials. And I'm also part of, I'm on the board of directors for the Urban Manufacturing Alliance, which is a national organization that focuses on bringing more manufacturing back to the U.S. And so as this has all taken shape, we've had a lot of meetings with people across the country to, try to figure out support for manufacturers who are in the same situation that Sewell Valley is in, where they're pivoting and they need support and they need, financial support in order to grow and to take on the task that's at hand. But also we are looking at figuring out how do we create legislation to, kind of mandate that PPE production going forward into the future would have to be done in the U.S. So how do we really secure that, how do we take care of these businesses long term as they pivot, but also for national and economic security and health security? How do we bring a lot of that capability back to the U.S.?
I've got 30 seconds left, Rosie. And last time we had you on, we talked about the significance of local manufacturing as it relates to the clothing industry. What do you think the impact is on what had been a surge in interest in this field?
Locally, you mean?
Sure.
Yeah. So, we have been busier than ever. Our inquiries are not stopping, and that is including PPE projects and other things. So, I anticipate our micro factory gaining quite a bit of, legs here and really increasing our capacity and output. I mean, we're going to totally change the focus to increasing our mass capacity and increasing whatever we can to help out with the situation.
Rosie Kovacs and Jessica Hemmer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you
very much.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks.